What's this?
5,000. You walk away and don't mess with my investors.
Bribe Mikey?
Call it whatever you want, Pete. I need this deal.
Shh. You hear that? Used to work these hills. I knew this lady. She was out walking her little poodle. And a coyote comes charging out of the brush, snatches up the little poodle and takes off. All we ever found of that little doggy was its diamond-studded leash. You know, when Karen first met you, she actually thought you were different than her gambling father.
What?
It's very interesting how people follow patterns. See, she doesn't feel safe with you either, Michael. And Karen needs to feel protected from when those coyotes come charging out of the brush.
You listen to me. You stay the fuck away from her.
Assaulting a police officer? A nice civilized man like you, Michael?
What are you gonna do? Arrest me?
Arrest you? I could kill you.
Ray Liotta passed away on May 26th at the age of 67 while filming a new project. Liotta has been a fixture in film and television since the mid-1980s, and audiences likely best know him from his roles as Henry Hill in Goodfellas, Shoeless Joe Jackson in Field of Dreams, most recently as Aldo in The Many Saints of Newark, and from his co-starring role in the crime series Shades of Blue. Other credits include Something Wild, Unlawful Entry, Operation Dumbo Drop, Copland, Hannibal, Narc, Wild Dogs, Killing Them Softly, and Hubie Halloween. Liotta commanded a certain danger and unpredictability that few of his peers possessed. One of his final roles will be in the upcoming Elizabeth Banks-directed Cocaine Bear, which seems apt considering that pretty much sums up his acting style. Cocaine Bear. He left behind friends, a family, and fans around the globe who were just looking for someone to talk to them the way he does to Karen. There will never be another Ray Liotta, and we are all the sorrier for it. Rest in peace. Now, on to the show.
Country roses, blessed songs, mommy's here, daddy's gone, broken promises, gin and rye, all the mean and hurtful things that make baby Jesus cry.
Hello, and welcome to Movies with Gravy, a podcast with all the fixins. I'm your host, Billy Ray Bruton. Hi, hello. Hope your day's going great. It's raining here in Seattle. Hopefully it is, well, if you like the rain, hopefully it's raining where you are. If you don't like the rain, then hopefully it's dry as a bone where you are. I'm very excited about today's episode. I've been a big fan of Mark O'Brien's as an actor for a while now, and I'm super thrilled to be chatting with him later in this episode about his feature directorial debut, The Righteous. But before that, we're going to do that thing we do on this podcast where we talk about the movie and the films that inspired it, you know, kind of the general conceit of this podcast. And joining us for that is a columnist at Bloody Disgusting who also writes for Daily Dead and Scream Magazine. Michelle Swope is in the house. Michelle.
Hello.
Hello. Welcome to the gravy.
Oh, thank you so much. I love gravy.
Well, you know what? Why even beat around the bush? What's your favorite kind of gravy?
Oh, that's hard. See, my husband's a chef, so.
Oh, so like an executive chef?
Yes.
Ooh, that's exciting. I'm a foodie.
He makes his own gravy, so I had one of his special gravies, I would say.
Yeah, I also am a big gravy maker myself. So, you know, my personal favorite gravy, I mean, it changes depending on my mood, but most of the time it's going to be your traditional brown gravy.
You can't go wrong with that.
You can't go wrong. I mean, you can't go wrong with any gravy. Basically.
True.
I mean, some people get a little weirded out by red eye gravy, but what's just some coffee and lard.
Exactly. Exactly.
So just so folks at home know, I saw this film a while ago and was really, and when I say the film, I mean The Righteous, the film that we're going to talk about. And I was really blown away by it, not only as a directorial debut, which is something, but just, you know, like I said, having followed Mark's work as an actor, it was just a surprising debut from him for me. And so I did sort of a journeyman's quest. I went through every single review of this film I could find, thinking, you know what? I'm going to find the person that I feel like likes this film on the same level that I do. And that just happened to be Michelle.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I saw the film last year at Fantasia. And
same.
Was, like you said, blown away as far as it being his directorial debut. There's so many layers to the film and his performance. Oh, my God. He's so good in this.
He really is. And before Michelle and I go too deep, we're going to take a quick moment to play a snippet of the trailer from the film so you can get kind of a sense of what we're talking about. So take a listen to that and we'll be right back.
We've all sinned. Sin. It has a life of its own. What's important is knowing the difference between what's real and what our conscience has created to punish us. Nothing ends so long as you stay on God's path. Bring me my penance.
Who are you?
Is he okay? We don't even know this boy.
It's the right thing to do. Who are you?
I really like having him in the house.
Imagine being born into a body nobody wants.
This is crazy.
Is it?
Can you tell me what the voice of God sounds like?
Sin. It can possess.
You can't run from this. Your punishment, you don't get to choose the conditions.
It can make us see things and hear things.
Does God scare you more than the devil, is that it?
Yes!
Why?
Because!
Be careful what you wish for. But be certain what you pray for.
So that was a piece of the trailer for The Righteous. And boy, oh boy, you know, Michelle, I'm going to let you tell our listening audience what you think this film is about. What's your plot synopsis for this film?
Are we going to talk spoilers? Because I have spoilers.
Yes. we generally don't avoid spoilers on this show. I would say tread lightly with the spoilers, but you don't have to avoid them entirely.
Okay. My plot synopsis of the film would be there's a priest named Frederick,
yep,
who has left the priesthood because he has been questioning his faith. He recently has suffered a tragedy, he and his wife, Ethel. And one night, this stranger dressed all in black shows up in their backyard asking for help. It's a very strange situation. They've just been to a funeral that day. And then the rest of the movie is conversations, basically, between the stranger, whose name is Aaron, who's Mark O'Brien, and Frederick. And they talk about faith and maybe some of the reasons that Frederick is questioning his faith. And maybe the reason that Aaron, the stranger, has showed up at his house in the middle of the night. So, I have a couple of theories about, you know, who or what Aaron might be. Obviously, I think it's left up to interpretation, but I kind of have several, which I'll say.
Yeah. I think that ending specifically is open to interpretation, and we will get to that. Ending. Yeah. That was as good of a synopsis as I could have given. This is
It's hard to talk about this film without talking about the form of the film, because it is, you know, the first filmmaker that came to mind when I was watching this was Dreyer, because it has that sort of starkness. It has that sort of isolationist feeling to it that you get from a lot of Dreyer's work. You know, the black and white cinematography also helps with that. And, you know, I'm one of those people, I like films that don't give me easy answers. And I like the films where I have to work and I have to think and I have to like put in the effort. And you certainly have to do that with this film, because yes, there are a lot of allegories at play here. And it would be easy to just call this a, you know, a religious horror film, which I guess to some degree it is. But this registered more to me as like a folk horror film.
Oh, I would agree. And I'll probably reference, I got to interview Mark last year for Fantasia about this movie because I loved it so much and I had to talk to him about it. It's intentionally black and white.
Yeah.
He did that for a reason, which, you know, quickly becomes obvious when you watch the film. I agree. I think it is somewhat a folk horror. You could certainly say that. It's such a unique film. And for me, like you said, the fact that it's his directorial debut, you know, he wrote it, he directed it, he stars in it, he gives a phenomenal performance in this movie. Everything about it just blew me away.
Yeah, you produced it also, like wears every yes. possible hat that you can wear in this. And I, like I mentioned earlier, I was just struck, you know, having only known Mark's work as an actor. I think the first time that he ever really popped on my radar as an actor was The Front Runner. And that's when it was like, oh, who's this guy? And then I went down the rabbit hole. And I don't know, this just seemed like such an unusual choice for a debut feature. But at this, I mean, well, and I say unusual, that's probably not fair. I think I wouldn't say that if it hadn't been pulled off so insanely well. I just don't expect debut films to have this kind of heft to them, and to have because it does. I mean, this feels like a film from a really assured filmmaker, and you know, and obviously evident, and obviously he is. But it, and it's not his first film in general. He's done a lot of short films, but according to him, been doing film since he was a kid. So obviously understands filmmaking on a real deep level. But even still, you just don't get this kind of polish on a debut feature from most filmmakers. And that's in everything from the way he directs the actors, from the pacing, from just the way, like the hammer that he uses to deploy that sound design. And I think the sound design is just as much of a character in this film as anybody else, because it is so persistent and so, it just gets at you throughout the whole film.
Yeah, it absolutely does. And not just the fact that it's black and white, but the use of shadow and light yeah. in the film. There's a couple of scenes I know where Aaron and Frederick are having these really intense conversations and the room just suddenly gets darker.
Yeah, yeah.
Things like that. And it adds this additional supernatural element to the
right.
movie.
Right. And that's the thing is like, it is not overtly supernatural.
Yeah.
Like, it is not like it is there if you want to read into it. But what I also appreciate about this film is it's set in no real finite time and place. Like it is, you know, you take a look at like, you know, the sets and the way people are dressed and even the accents and like, it's all very much, it's tricking you to some degree. I think about, I don't know, and I don't know why this makes me think of this, but I think about Top Gun Maverick, since that's what's on everybody's brains right now. And the yeah. fact that they go through that whole movie without naming the enemy country. It's just a country. They never name it. Take your guess. I kind of felt the same way about this in the sense of like, just kind of guess when and where it is. Like, that's up to you. And that adds to that sort of supernatural, sort of ethereal quality. You know, again, the sound design adds to that as well. Because like I said, there's not a moment of silence in this movie. Even when it's silent, there's a howl of the wind behind, or there's a rustle in the trees. Like there is something always back there. And I guess, I mean, and that kind of plays into this character the Fred character, who, you know, is being haunted and being by his past and by his choices and by his regrets and like how he probably doesn't have a moment of silence in his head. And I think that sound design really does a good job of echoing that.
Oh, absolutely. I definitely agree with all of that. As far as the sound design, it's so good. And it really just keeps you interested in the story as well. And there's also a very dreamlike feel to this movie. Like there's times where you question, is this really happening? You know, there's kind of this dreams versus reality element to the story. You know, is this even happening? Is Frederick imagining this? You know, is this a dream that he's having?
It's funny that you mentioned that. We'll get into that when we get into our recommendations, because that is the basis for one of my recommendations, is exactly what you just said. But yeah, it is something. It is one of those things where you can read it in so many different ways. And obviously that's what he intended. And that's my kind of film. Like I just am not someone who wants, I mean, sometimes I'm like everybody else. I want an easy resolution to something. I want it to be nice and tidy and handed to me on a silver platter. Like, but most of the time I'm much more engaged in a film that is making my brain do the work, that isn't handing me everything. And this film hands you nothing. Like there are things that, I mean, the way he unfolds the developments in this film, I think is really kind of brilliant. Like, you know, you start off with this film and you know, okay, this couple have suffered this, you know, this tragedy, you know, they have suffered this horrible loss, this loss of a child. That in itself would have been a good enough, you know, kickoff point. Then we get my favorite scene in the film, which is the scene with the Doris character. And it's the first scene where Doris is there. And it's the one where I call it the most uncomfortable scene, because we've all been in that situation where you're in a conversation with somebody who is not picking up your social cues. And then you're desperately wanting that conversation to end, but they're just not catching on. That is the Doris scene in a nutshell. But that's the scene where you realize, oh, it's not their kid. And so it's like, it just keeps on building complications. And I just really, really appreciated that.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And one of the things that I really love about this movie is the way that Mark plays the character of Aaron. His character kind of evolves throughout the movie and through the conversations that he has with Frederick. You know, in the beginning, he seems very innocent. He has this Southern accent. You know, he seems very innocent and helpless. And as the story unfolds, he begins to have a much more sinister feel.
Yeah.
That is so effective. You know, you can't take your eyes off of him. You know, you're like kind of hanging on everything that his character says because of how he plays it, how the character changes.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Like you singled out his performance, which I think was appropriate. I mean, let's be clear. Everybody here gives a great performance. It's so nice to see Henry Cherney in a lead role.
Yes.
Because you just don't get to see, you know, he's one of those actors that you've seen for decades and you're like, oh, that guy. And so, and so it's so nice to see him get the opportunity to show that he's more than just, you know, the character actor or things like that. And I was not familiar with the woman who played Ethel. Mimi, is it Kitchick? I think it's Kitchick.
I believe she was on Hill Street Blues. Are you not old enough to remember that?
Oh, probably not.
That's a long time ago.
But now that you say that, I'm looking at her filmography now, and I'm like, oh wait, like I can picture her now, weirdly, from The Day After Tomorrow.
Yeah.
Like that's where I'm envisioning from. But yeah, Hill Street Blues. Okay. Well, that makes more sense now. Okay. So she is, this was my first time like really seeing her in this kind of role. And then, you know, obviously Mark is just, you know, tremendous in this. And, you know, I think that's what elevates this film to a degree. And I say elevates, not calling it elevated horror, because I hate that terminology, but it does elevate this because, you know, my biggest problem with a lot of horror films, and you know, and this is my debate when you know people throw around the elevated horror banner a lot. To me, all elevated horror is a horror film with really good actors. Like that's the difference. It's like really great actors, and this film has them in spades for sure. And but you know, I would say that the performance I probably latched onto the most was Mark's performance, just because it is so kinetic and it is so like it's so wild and unexpected. And you know, you're the Ethel and Fred characters are not supposed to be that. You know, they're more reserved. They're more in their own heads. And but boy, man, does Mark just deliver in this role, like such, and to do that, to give such a performance when you're also directing a script that you wrote and you're also producing, like that's just mind-boggling to me. As someone who made a feature themselves a few years ago and also wrote, directed, and produced it, like I don't know how you do that, let alone act in it as well.
Oh yeah, I totally agree. That's one of the reasons why I was so blown away by this movie. I was like, oh my God, like he literally did everything and then turned in the most amazing performance on top of it.
Yeah.
You know, like that's pretty impressive to me.
Well, let's do this. So we're going to get into some spoiler territory right now. So if you want to avoid the spoiler chat, I'm going to say, you know, skip ahead 5 minutes. And then join us if you don't want to have the film spoiled. And I would probably encourage you to do that if you haven't seen it, because I do think you want the surprises to unfold for you. But I'm going to stop right now for 2 seconds. This is your chance to leave, audience, and then you're getting spoiled for you. Okay, that ending.
Yes.
That ending. So essentially, without giving away every detail of how the film, we'll just say, something transpires between the characters. The Henry Sherney character rushes out of the house, and there are what can only be described as, well, they're balls of fire raining down from the sky. Three balls of fire. And I certainly read that as a sort, I mean, I certainly read that as biblical. Is that how you read it?
Oh, absolutely. There's a conversation between him and another priest a little bit earlier in the film, where they're talking about the coming of the four horsemen and the apocalypse, and the other priest specifically talks about a fireball.
You know, you say that, and now it's in my head. I'm like, how did I miss that? How did I not connect that together at the end? Now you said it, and I'm like, well, yeah, now it makes all the sense in the world.
But and there's also a lot of fire in this movie, which I didn't notice until I watched it again. I was like, oh, that's something I didn't pick up. Like, there's a fire in the beginning of the movie. You know, and as the movie progresses, there's a lot of use of fire that you might not notice the first time you watch it. And it kind of goes with that ending with the fireballs in the sky. But again, you know, you could be sitting there saying, is this really happening?
Yeah, absolutely. And so what is your take? Who is Aaron? What is Aaron? What's your take?
Well, I can't just say one thing. I think Aaron could be the devil.
Sure.
Aaron could be the embodiment of Frederick's sins, because, and I base that on the conversations that they have where they talk about God. You know, do you know who you're really praying to? He asked Frederick, are you sure you're praying to God? Yeah. Things like that. And then where one time he says something like, he heard Frederick praying and his prayers possessed him.
Yeah. Yeah. I am not far off in that interpretation. I read it very much as, you know, we hear all the time about like battling your demons. This to me was, what if your personal demons were in human form?
Yes.
That's the way. Yeah. It's like, so in my mind, he is a demon. He is he is Fred's demon.
Yes. Exactly.
And then that opens up the question, well, does he exist outside of Fred? Well, obviously he does, because Ethel also sees him and interacts. Well,
it could still be a dream, though. Couldn't Frederick be having
Sure. Oh, it absolutely
Ethel's in.
Absolutely. Absolutely he could. It could definitely be a dream. It could definitely be, I mean, there's so many interpretations. That's what's so great about it. Is that it's not wrapped up in a neat bow. And, I liked the idea, because I initially I was like, oh, is he the devil? But then is it when I was like, no, he's not the devil. Like, I don't think he's the devil.
I think that would always be too simple. Don't you?
Me too. Yeah, me too. I think that's, having seen the film, I don't think as a director, I don't think Mark would have gone that simple.
Yeah, I agree.
And I agree. I like the idea of like, what if our personal demons were in human form and taunting us and using them against us. And like, I like that idea. And it, of course, brings about some revelations about the Fred character, which I won't spoil those for everybody, but they were unexpected to me. And I thought they did a good job of laying them out and revealing them in a compelling way. Because like you said, most of this movie is just conversation.
Yeah.
So like, there's not a lot, if you're going into this expecting a lot of like, don't expect going in expecting gore and jump scares and like your typical horror movie set pieces. Like, this is a chamber piece to a large degree.
Yes. Yes. And there are plenty of movies that are just conversations. You know, and I had someone say to me when I was raving about it after Fantasia, oh, well, someone told me it was slow. I said, it's an extremely slow burn. You know what I mean? Like, it's that way for a reason. And that's part of what I think makes it so effective. Because it, like I mentioned earlier, I was literally on the edge of my seat, you know, listening to the conversation and how Aaron like kind of transforms, not physically, but you know, his demeanor as he becomes more and more sinister, and you're questioning, what is he? Who is he? Like we just said, I think the devil's too simple of an answer. I think there's way more to it than that. You know, would you agree?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I think there's definitely more to it. And, it's interesting, like, there are so many reads on it. And I, even just sitting here thinking, I'm like, I was thinking about the possibility of like, you know, what if, I like the idea that he was sort of listening to his prayers.
Yeah.
Like, so almost like a super fan and got addicted.
Yeah.
And like, because then like, when you're talking about the transformation of the Aaron character, it's like, well, what happens like when you meet your idols a lot of the time, or like your, or the people that you're like, you, like you meet them, it's all fine at first. And then slowly and surely you start to peel away the layers. And I don't know, I'm just, my brain's going in a million different ways thinking about all the things this can mean. And that doesn't happen a lot for me. Like, my brain doesn't, I mean, my brain works, but it doesn't dwell on the possibilities of something as much as this film has forced it to do.
Oh, I totally agree. I've thought about this movie for a year. I mean, literally.
Yeah.
But right after I saw it, I could not stop thinking about it, you know? For so many reasons, and it just stuck with me. There's also some people, I know the religious aspect of the movie may appeal to them, you know, depending on how religious you are.
Sure.
You know, in your personal life, some people will appreciate that part of the film. There's a lot of really interesting conversations about religion in general and about God stuck with me. I'm not super religious, but
me either.
Those things really stuck with me. Like, I couldn't stop thinking about the questions that Aaron poses to Frederick. You know, are you sure you're praying to God? You know?
Yeah. What's things interesting, like that. What's interesting about like religion to me, especially in film, is I'm also not a religious person. And I almost feel like weirdly religious context, religious speak, almost plays better to non-religious people because we don't have all the attachments to it. Like, we don't have the emotional attachments, the spiritual attachments, whatever they are. We're able to take it at sort of face value and actually absorb the words in a logical way without attaching all that other BS onto it. And so I feel like it gives the non-religious folks like us a bit of an upper hand.
You might be right, because I feel that way too. Like, you know, I tend to really like horror movies that are well done and have religious themes like this one does. And they sometimes really strike me on a personal level, even though I'm not a religious person.
Yeah.
And you know, I'll think about it for a long time.
Well, that's because, you know, you think about it, and a lot of what religion is promoting, a lot of what it's promoting in terms of like text and in terms of like, you know, actuality, are actually good concepts to a large degree. Like, they are promoting to some degree like morality and values. And when it gets into like picking and choosing what's what, that's when it gets difficult. But like, religion does offer some good things. However, 99% of the people who employ those good things do so in a, I feel like, terrible way. And so that's where it gets tricky. But like, that's the thing where like, you're, when we hear these things and we're not attached to them on some other level, we can just take them and they're a little more profound, I think, and they mean more because they do touch onto this fundamental idea of like, they touch on morality and values and goodness and decency and all these things. And I just the religion sometimes will turn me off of a film. Sometimes if I think it's going to be hackneyed, I had no concerns about this from like the first moment of the movie. I was like, okay, I'm not worried about, you know, being hand fed, you know, some religious mumbo jumbo.
Yeah. I'm so glad that you said that because I haven't thought about it that way as far as, you know, the religious context being more profound to people like us. But I think you're right. And that's now that's a really interesting concept because that totally makes sense to me. That's how I feel when I watch a movie like this. And I agree. I'm just like you. If a movie is, you know, super religious and it's trying to spoon feed you, you know, whatever its agenda is, that usually doesn't appeal to me.
Yeah. Well, you think about it. I'm going to use Rosemary's Baby as an example because Mark in our interview mentions that that's his sort of favorite horror film and the film was a big inspiration. And so, you know, I look at it like in the end of that film, you've got all those folks around, hail Satan, hail Satan, hail Satan. Well, if you hear that and you're, let's pick a religion. Let's say you're Christian. Let's say you hear that. Maybe it's shocking because at the time it came out. But if you think about it, you're probably not really concerned because you're a Christian. You know Jesus has got your back. You know you're not in trouble. You know you're not in danger. Like, we don't have that comfort.
Yeah.
Because we don't have that belief. So when you hear hail Satan, it's like, oh shit.
Yes.
It's getting real now.
Me too. I'm like, oh no. You know, yes, yeah. This is great because I have never thought about it this way. And you're exactly right. That's how it affects me too.
Well, so we do a thing on this show where we rate the films that we've just discussed and we do it by what I call the Waffle House rating system. Have you ever been to a Waffle House, Michelle?
Waffle House is awesome. I'm from the South. Of course I have.
Wait, what part of the South are you from? How do we not have this? How do I not know this?
North Carolina.
Okay, I'm Alabama. I thought you had, I thought I detected the accent there, but I didn't place North Carolina.
Yes, Southern people know Southern people.
Oh yeah, so you know Waffle House. Well, this is our rating system. So a film, it can be smothered, which means it's not worth your time. It can be smothered and covered, which means it's watchable. Or it can be smothered and covered and chunked, which means it's highly recommended. I will certainly smother, cover, and chunk The Righteous.
Oh, me too. Absolutely. And you've got to have a cup of that Waffle House coffee.
Oh, God. The Waffle House coffee, my go-to used to be, Waffle House used to have this combo deal where you got a cup of coffee, a half a BLT, and a cup of Burt's chili.
Yes. Yes.
And I used to get it all the time. And they've stopped the combo now. They don't have it anymore. But damn, I love that.
Oh, Waffle House is the best. Yeah, the people that are not Southern are probably going to think we're crazy. But seriously, if you've never been to a Waffle House, please go. It's wonderful.
Where else are you going to go on a Christmas Eve when everything else is closed?
I know, exactly.
You're going to go to Waffle House. So we're both smother, covering, and chunking this. It's already, you know, in my top 10 of the year. So I mean, it is. It's definitely recommended. Arrow Films is putting out a pretty impressive release of this film. It's also going to be available for street or for VOD. It will, by the time you hear this, it will be available, I believe, the 10th is when it's available. I think that's right.
Yes.
I think it's the 10th where you can find it. And I do recommend that you do. I think you're going to get a kick out of it. I think you get a lot out of it. And then, blow up, put your reviews on Letterboxd and show the filmmakers how much you love it. Because that's what we do now. We use Letterboxd, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. I am just so happy this movie is finally getting released because, like I said, I have thought about this movie and talked about this movie for the past year.
Yeah. And the fact that Arrow is putting it out with such a cool release, I think is really awesome. Like that's getting an Arrow release is a big deal. So, you know, if they think your film's cool, you're on pretty good grounds.
Yes, definitely.
Well, now is the time when Michelle and I are going to curate for you your very own movie mixtape inspired by the film we just discussed, The Righteous. So the idea with these, Michelle, is that your three films, my three films, and The Righteous can all go together in like a mixtape that someone could say, if they've got 12 hours to kill, is going to be like, you know what? I'm going to watch all six of the, or all seven of these films. And we actually have people do that. So people are insane.
Oh, but that's awesome.
Yeah, that's, it's awesome. I feel bad for their bodies subjecting them to that many hours, but I appreciate it. I appreciate that people actually do that. You are our guest. So you get to decide, would you like me to go first or would you like yourself to go first?
I'll go first because you already mentioned one of my movies.
Oh, okay. Let's do that.
Well, my first movie is A Nightmare on Elm Street.
Oh, okay.
And that might sound weird, but the fact that this movie could be a dream and it deals with things that are very dreamlike, the entire movie has a very dreamlike feel to me. So because there's dreams, the movie itself could be a dream. And then the obvious theme of good versus evil, so A Nightmare on Elm Street is my first recommendation.
Well, I'm a huge Nightmare on Elm Street fan, so that's never going to be a bad way to go as far as I'm concerned.
Oh, good. Yes. Me too. Huge, huge fan. My next movie would be...
Well, no, hold on. Wait, hold on one second. Oh. We're going to take turns.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
Hey, that's okay. No, Nightmare on Elm Street. I think that's a good... because you're right. Like, you don't know if it's a dream or not. Like, it's kind of in that weird middle area, and so much of the Nightmare on Elm Street franchise exists in that area as well. And you know what's crazy to me also, why I'm also glad that you mentioned that, because I feel like a lot of guests on this show, and this is not to throw shade on any of my fabulous guests, because they're all fabulous, but people tend to always want to go for, like, the obscure stuff. And I'm like, I don't think people realize how few people in the younger generations have never seen Nightmare on Elm Street.
I saw Nightmare on Elm Street in the theater.
You know what's funny? That's the first film I ever saw in a theater. I was 2 years old. My mother couldn't find a babysitter, and she drugged me to see Nightmare on Elm Street.
Oh, see, that's awesome. I'm a little bit older than you, but that's awesome. I wish my parents would have taken me to see it to see movies like that when I was a little kid. No, but it's the movie has had such a profound effect on me. I tell people that it's the reason I'm a horror fan all these years later, because of that experience in the theater.
Yeah, I mean, I would say Nightmare on Elm Street is probably the main reason that I love horror as much as I do, because I was obsessed with that franchise as a kid. And anytime I talk to someone now who's younger, when I say younger, in their 20s, like, and they're like, oh, I've never seen a Nightmare on Elm Street, I'm like, oh my God. Like, I'm just like, I'm flummoxed every time I hear it. And I think people take for granted, because people our age, of course we've seen Nightmare on Elm Street, but all these films don't necessarily trickle down to the folks coming in after us. And we have to be sure that we're curating the classics to some degree as well.
Definitely. And I get excited when young people discover these movies.
Oh God, absolutely. You know? I've had the joy of watching Nightmare on Elm Street with a friend of mine who's younger for the first time, and just getting to experience them experiencing it, like experiencing all the scary stuff, but also the cheesy stuff. And it's wonderful.
I bet that was awesome.
Yeah, it's wonderful. So my first choice is, I mentioned this earlier, you're talking about not knowing if something is a dream or not. And this film popped into my head, and it's a brand new film. So I don't know if I've ever played a film in a mixtape that is this new, but the film that I chose is Alex Garland's Men.
I haven't seen that yet.
Yeah, it just came out within the past month. It stars Jesse Buckley as this woman who is sort of getting over the loss of a loved one, similar to The Righteous. It is her fiance, or her husband rather, who has, she's not sure if he has committed suicide, if he fell, but he has fallen from a window in some capacity. And so she goes on this sort of retreat to the English countryside, this gorgeous manor house where she's hoping to get away and heal. And that does not happen. Immediately, she starts having these encounters with these men. And the men are all played by the same actor, Roy Kinnear. And you never quite know if it is, if Jesse Buckley's character is dreaming all this. You never know if it's rooted in any kind of reality. It is way more ambiguous, I would say, than even The Righteous is. Though, I mean, you can look at Men as a very simple setup and a simple premise, which it kind of is, because the movie is all about sort of like the patriarchy and how the patriarchy expands and you know, and I don't know. This was just, it just popped into my head when I was thinking about The Righteous again after my rewatch, because I do think they share a lot of DNA. I think both films share some commonality. I think they'd make a really interesting double feature.
I was already excited to see Men, but that makes me more excited to see it.
Yeah, it's not for everybody. Like, it is, Alex Garland is always an acquired taste. Mm-hmm. This more than either of his other films, I feel like, because this film almost feels like he is intentionally positing questions that he knows he's not going to answer and that he knows are going to drive you crazy.
Wow. Yes, I am very much looking forward to seeing that.
But what is your next choice, Michelle?
My next choice is Rosemary's Baby, which you mentioned.
Oh, yep.
So you spoiled it just a tiny bit for me, but
I blame Mark for spoiling that.
Yes, of course. We'll just blame Mark for that. But in Rosemary's Baby, probably for obvious reasons, you know, it deals with the devil, and good versus evil, and there's also an extremely dreamlike quality to that movie as well.
Throughout. Oh yeah. And not even just even the music of Rosemary's Baby is dreamlike.
Yeah.
It adds to that. And I would say the music to The Righteous has a similar feel as well. Absolutely. Rosemary's Baby. I mean, considering that film absolutely did inspire this film, it's perfect for the mixtape.
He actually didn't tell me that in our interview. I promise I didn't cheat.
He didn't actually say so much that it was an inspiration on this film as it is his favorite horror film.
Yes.
But still, it's the great inclusion for that reason alone. And yeah, Rosemary's Baby holds up phenomenally well. I watched that recently again a few weeks ago. It's still a really scary film.
Oh yeah, definitely.
Yeah, it is the stuff of nightmares, and that ending is still one of the all-time great endings for me. And not so much what the old folks are saying, but Mia Farrow's reactions are what makes that ending so amazing.
Yes, I agree.
Great choice. Wonderful choice. So my next choice is a bit of an outlier, but it is one. This is a film that I adore, that usually when I mention it, no one else has seen it, because it was notoriously very difficult to find for a very long time. And it is the 1957 French adaptation of Arthur Miller's The Crucible.
Oh my goodness, I have not seen that.
It is very hard to find. It is absolutely difficult to find. I have an international copy, which is why I have it now, my physical copy. But for years, you could not find it, because when it first came out, I mean, Arthur Miller was trying desperately to keep people from being able to see it. It's directed by Raymond Rouleau. It is written by Jean-Paul Sartre, of all people. Like, it is just an incredible adaptation of The Crucible. For folks who don't know what The Crucible is, it's set in 1692, Salem, Massachusetts. It is at the height of sort of the witch trial hysteria. And it follows John and Elizabeth Proctor, who, John has had this affair with their maid Abigail and spurned her. And then Abigail has now started accusing people of being witches and of witchcraft, which is now starting all of these trials and all of this commotion. And, you know, the black and white cinematography here by Claude Renoir, who, you know, is one of the greats. Like, this has just such a stacked cast and crew, and is, in my mind, the best adaptation of The Crucible ever. And, it still has a lot of the problematic aspects of The Crucible. You know, I think about the Tituba character and things like that, but, it's really great. Like, this one is really creepy too. And the sparseness and sort of the stoicism of it reminded me a lot of The Righteous. And this really was sort of the first film. I remember watching this Fantasia, and this film came into my mind watching it then. So if you haven't seen The Crucible, track it down. This version, again, is the 1957 version and is certainly worth watching.
I need to see if I can track that down because that sounds amazing.
Oh, yeah. It's great. It's great. It's really cool. It makes some changes from the play text, but it does some interesting things with it. I'll say that.
Wow. Okay. I'm actually currently making notes because I need to try and track that down.
yeah. Okay. What is your third and final mixtape selection?
My third and final movie recommendation is Night of the Living Dead.
Ooh.
And the 1968. Sorry, I guess I need to specify nowadays. and not just because it's black and white. That obviously helps because The Righteous is black and white. But the fact that it deals with isolation.
Yeah.
And again, the good versus evil themes. And also a lot of the outside shots in The Righteous reminded me of Night of the Living Dead for some reason.
No, I get that. I absolutely understand that. And it's what's so funny is our choices have weirdly synced up. Like Nightmare on Elm Street and Men follow the sort of dream theme. Rosemary's Baby and Crucible, the devil.
Yes.
And then Night of the Living Dead and my next one are also similar because they're both about the isolationist part of this film. And so it's fun that they kind of sync up. But you know, Night of the Living Dead, another film, holds up spectacularly well. I've watched it, 100 times. Yeah. I agree. I think the way they shoot the exteriors here is reminiscent to a large degree of Night of the Living Dead. And I also think some of the lighting reminded me of it as well, too.
Yes,
There is a thing that both films do where sometimes the lights are brighter than you realize they would be. Mm-hmm. And that's something that both films do that I really enjoy. It's something that several films have done, but I really enjoy that. And I think promoting classics is just as important as promoting the underdogs. Because again, like I guarantee you, if I went up and asked a random 20-year-old movie person, they probably haven't seen Night of the Living Dead.
Oh my goodness, that makes me sad.
I mean, I don't say that like shitting on that generation
not at all.
It's just that, you know, your average movie fan, you know, I bet they've seen 28 Days Later. I bet you they've seen, you know, the remake of Dawn of the Dead, but, you know, they might not have seen Night of the Living Dead. And that is crazy. And that is sad.
Yeah. But I mean, like I was saying, and I agree with you, I would never, you know, talk down on someone because they haven't seen a movie. I get excited when people discover those movies, the older movies that are amazing. I mean, that excites me. I mean, everyone is welcome in genre film. And, you know, it doesn't matter how old you are. If you're still discovering the classics, that's awesome.
Yeah, absolutely. And so my final choice does fit into that isolationist theme. It is what I have come to realize my favorite horror film ever made. And I didn't put this together when I was interviewing Mark, and I'm trying not to spoil the whole interview before people listen to it, but I mentioned this film to him, and then he gets this real excited look on his face. He's like, oh, wait, do you know? Did you know? And as soon as he said that, it clicked in my head that his wife is the co-star of that film.
Oh, my goodness.
And that film is Pontypool.
Oh!
Pontypool is a boy, and this has gone from being my favorite horror film of the past like two decades to being, I think, my favorite horror film ever made. And it's from 2008, directed by Bruce McDonald. It is a Canadian horror film, which also fits because Mark is very much Canadian. It is based on a play, I believe, or a novel. It's actually based on a novel called Pontypool Changes Everything. And it's set in the small town of Pontypool, Ontario. It's about this radio announcer named Grant Mazzy, played by Stephen McHattie, who is his producer, essentially, who is producing the show. And essentially, without spoiling too much, something bizarre starts happening outside of the radio station. And all we get from it is audio. We're hearing people call in. We're hearing the reports coming through the radio station. We never really leave the radio station. It is all set there. And it's sort of like War of the Worlds, like Orson Welles' War of the Worlds, and that we're hearing all of this stuff, but not really seeing it. And what's being described is very crazy and very scary and very ominous. And then it starts getting into the station, and it's basically this virus that starts messing with the way people communicate and their words. And the virus is transmitted through words, through the English language, and that's how you catch it. And it is just a fascinating film. It is impeccably well directed and acted. And, you know, for all the reasons I mentioned, I think it's a great addition for this list. You know, Mark's wife is in the film. It is a Canadian horror film. And it does have that isolation because it is set in, you know, that radio station. And you don't really break out of that. And, boy, I just love this film. And you know, it's one of those that anytime I can turn a person onto this film, I'm proud of myself.
Oh, Pontypool is fantastic. And actually, I need to go back and revisit it because it's been a couple of years. That's such a great addition to this mixtape. I would not have thought of that.
Yeah, I wouldn't have thought of it either had I not just interviewed Mark yesterday and made the connection that his wife was in it.
Wow. Yes, I definitely need to go back and revisit. It is fantastic.
Oh, it really is. We did an episode a year or two ago. We did, I think it was underrated horror films. Oh, no, it was me and Elric Kane did an episode on underrated horror films. And this was, I believe, the top of my list.
Oh, yeah.
I believe this was the
top. I don't see enough people talk about Pontypool.
No one does. No one talks about Pontypool. And you mention it to them and you explain it to them. And they always seem like, eh. I'm like, you just got to watch it. Like, you just got to watch it. Like, it is such an experience and such a roller coaster, which is exactly what The Righteous is. You know, slow burn, yes, but still a roller coaster.
And it takes place in one location, just like The Righteous does. I mean, everything. Yeah,
absolutely.
That's such a great choice. I love that.
Well, this is our movie mixtape, folks. Obviously, The Righteous, but we also have A Nightmare on Elm Street, Men, Rosemary's Baby, The Crucible, Night of the Living Dead, and Pontypool. I'd say that's a pretty nice selection.
I like it.
I like that we have classics, we have some new stuff, some really old stuff, some obscure stuff. I think it's a good mix. This would have been, if I had made this mixtape in high school, I would have been very proud of it.
Yes, I agree. Absolutely.
Well, Michelle, tell our listening audience, where can people find you and your work and anything coming up that you want to turn people's attention to?
I have a column on Bloody Disgusting where I talk about paranormal things. I'm a regular contributor for Daily Dead, and my first piece in Scream Horror Magazine is coming out this month. It's a piece where I did several interviews with people who worked with Wes Craven, and I'm so excited for that to come out because it was such a wonderful experience.
Yeah, that sounds amazing. Yeah, Wes Craven's a hero, so I look very forward to checking that out.
Yes. And you can always find me on Twitter at Redhead from Mars. I'm usually there tweeting away.
Yep. That's what we all do, right? We just tweet.
Yep. And do. So.
Well, yeah. Well, to give some folks some quick plugs on our end, coming up on The Incinerator, which is our sister competition podcast, on June 9th, we are doing spoof films with William Bibbiani and Whitney Seibold. And then coming up next on Movies with Gravy, dropping the 21st, we're doing a special roundtable and ranking our favorite gay coming out films. And we're doing that with Travelle Anderson, Cameron Sheets from RuPaul's Drag Race, and Adam B. Vary from Variety. So that should be a really fun episode as well. We're of course on social media and Letterboxd at Movies with Gravy. You can find all about us and our movie mixtapes on Letterboxd when I get it updated. And I will eventually. I know I keep saying that, but I will eventually get it updated, everyone, I promise. Michelle, thank you so much for chatting with me.
Oh, thank you so much for asking me to do this. I could just talk about this movie all day long.
Oh, we'll bring you back to talk about something else.
Oh, that would be wonderful. And I'm, like I said, I'm so excited it's finally getting released so more people can see it. So this is all very exciting. So thank you for having me.
No, it was my pleasure. And yeah, again, Righteous is available on VOD on June 10th. And you can also purchase that really kick-ass Arrow Films packaging as well, which is what I did. I pre-ordered that shit. So check that out. Enjoy the film. Let us know what you think. And now for the rest of the show. If you're not familiar with Mark O'Brien's work as an actor, catch up. He's been tearing it up in films like Arrival, Goalie, Ready or Not, Marriage Story, and Blue Bayou, and on a parade of incredible series including Halt and Catch Fire, City on a Hill, The Last Tycoon, the recently concluded first season of 61st Street, and the upcoming second season of HBO's Perry Mason. The Righteous is his feature directorial debut. He was kind enough to sit down with us for a jovial chat, and you know we talked about Gravy. Oh, and did we mention he's Canadian, eh? Check out our chat right now. Mark O'Brien, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, man.
Where are you located at right now? Are you international or are you stateside?
I'm in international waters. Anything can happen. No, I live in Los Angeles. I'm in Toronto. We had this special screening of The Righteous last night. And I leave for Newfoundland tomorrow for the screening at home where I'm from on Friday. So I kind of am all over the place.
Canada, love our Canadian horror films. And I want to start out by asking you a very complex question. What's your favorite horror film? Or actually, you know what? Let me do that better, because what's your favorite scary movie sounds a little bit better. You can get the scream inflection there.
Rosemary's Baby.
That was a quick answer.
Yeah, it's the best. It's just, or The Wicker Man, but Rosemary's Baby is, I can't, that movie just creeps in and just doesn't go away. I love everything about that film.
Yeah, well, that's a good one. Usually people have to sit and pontificate for a while, but you knew right off the bat. See, people ask me that question. I can usually answer it too. Of course, my answer is very different, but is also a Canadian horror film, Pontypool, which is my favorite horror film. I adore that film.
What, do you know that's your favorite horror film?
That is my favorite horror film.
You know the connection I have to that?
Oh my goodness, your wife is in that, right?
Yeah,
that's wife. Right. That's right. I've been beating the Pontypool drum since it first came out, and right. I'm still waiting for everybody to catch on.
And Bruce is a friend too. I love him. He's a wonderful guy.
Yeah, fantastic filmmaker. Just an amazing, amazing film, amazing piece.
Yeah.
So when did your love of horror develop? I mean, have you always, I mean, first of all, let me ask you this. Do you consider The Righteous to be a horror film? Because I know some people who do, some people who don't.
Nothing pleases me more than some people do and some people don't. Wouldn't please me more. Everyone's like, well, what do you want people to walk out of thinking in this movie? I'm like, I want every single person to think something different than the person next to them. So the same thing with the genre. It's whatever you deem it to be. And because it twists and it turns, and that's what I meant it to do. And it's subjective.
Well, when it was recommended to me, it was recommended using terms that I actually hate. Elevated horror.
Yeah.
God, it's just the worst. But so anytime someone says, oh, you should watch this, it's elevated horror, I immediately go, but I was like, this isn't. Elevated horror is a fiction anyway.
Yeah.
So I like that response. I like that you want it to be everything to everyone. But where did your love of horror develop? Have you always been a fan of the genre? I know you're a big cinephile, but what specifically about horror?
No, I was not a fan at all up until not very long ago. I'd seen Rosemary's Baby really changed a lot for me when I finally watched it. I was scared to watch it because I was like, oh, this is going to mess me up. And then I think it's from watching so many movies, I was like, I've seen so many movies. I should probably try some horror movies. And like, obviously I'd seen horror movies, but it was like in the last 4 or 5 years, like very recently. And I'm a cinephile. I'm 38. I'm a cinephile for like, you know, 25 years. And it just clicked for me. I was like, wow, this is so much more interesting. So many more avenues for imagination and surrealism, and anything can happen at any moment. And, you know, Trojan horse to tell another story. So there's so many things about horror that I love, but it took that long. It just, I don't know why. And my friend, I have two friends. That's it. And they are huge horror fans. These two guys, and they're like, it's so funny that your first film is like a kind of a horror movie. Like, that's, you always hated them, and they'd always be recommending horror movies. I'm like, I don't want to. Don't want to watch it. Don't want to watch it. Don't want to watch it. And it's weird. So it very recent, man. Very recent.
So are you going to be a horror fan going forward, or is this just
Oh yes, I'm all aboard. I'm an Argento, Mario Bava. I'm into all of it. Gimme, gimme, gimme. I'm like, it's huge for me now. It's the thing. I don't like Gratuity, though. I don't like Slash or Cut 'Em Up. It just doesn't interest me personally. It's just a taste thing. It's not like, I don't think it's good. I think there are some really good bloody movies, but yeah, I'm full in. I'm all in.
Well, as a super fan of that genre, I think it's always great to have converts join our an insane pack. You know, when I first saw the film, a couple of things popped into mind almost instantly. Obviously, Dreyer. I'm sure you've gotten that before. It's not your first time hearing that. But also, you mentioned Wicker Man earlier, and this to me registered, even though I hadn't heard anybody really describe it as this when I saw it. It really struck me as very much a folk horror film in a lot of ways. And you know, and I'm curious, was that something that you were setting out to do? Was something folk horror-esque, or is that something that just sort of happened sort of narratively without you really knowing about it?
It sort of happened more pre-production without me really even knowing about it. It was gothic is the thing I was really kind of going for. And one of the reasons I want to do gothic is I do like gothic architecture and gothic things in general, but I've always loved cathedrals. Like I love gothic, the gothic nature of things, the minimalist pointy nature. But really the reason why I was going to be gothy is because gothic architecture is often very pointy, and I wanted everything to be pointing at Frederick. Everything's kind of a threat, and it's minimalist. A lot of gothic, you know, design is minimalist too. And it's like, I didn't want a lot of clutter in the house because it's just two of them. It's almost like they're any place. And so then that kind of led into it feeling more folk horror. And I guess that's because they're set out, it's out in the middle of nowhere where they are. So it's going to be that anyway, because it's turning into this thing. So why disregard it? Why not pay attention? Why not just lean into it and be like, okay, cool. That's what it's going to be. Let's make that so.
Yeah, you know, it's funny that you mentioned gothic, because I wrote down just a random note that just says Crazy Hammer vibes, which I assume means Hammer films so fits right in with the gothic sense as well. And you know, the decision to shoot in black and white, anytime a film makes that decision, I always go in like, I hope you earn this. And it's always nice when I see one that I don't even notice that it's black and white.
Yeah.
Where it just feels so integral to the story that you just don't even notice it.
Yeah, I feel the same. And that's why, and you know, obviously I'm being asked about black and white, and it just was. So to your reaction was to what mine was in writing it. I was like, oh, it's just black and white. I was on page 4 and I'm like, black and white. This movie should be black and white. It just should. And I think, and then you lean into the reasons why you thought that in a technical way and in a narrative way. So it becomes about that, like it's about his subconsciousness. So it's kind of murky and it's not really decipherable, and everything's, it's often at night and you're like, what is that? And at dreams and stuff like that. And like, cause your dreams, you don't really think about your dreams being in color, and the movie's kind of a nightmare in general. And so all those things, you're like, oh, this lends to it, black and white, good and bad, God and the devil, heaven and hell. All these things kind of now make this more informed. But I'm the same way as you, man. When I watch a movie, I don't like to out filmmakers. I mean, Alexander Payne is a fucking genius, but I don't know why Nebraska is black and white. I don't know why that movie's black and white. And so, and it's distracting. So sometimes for me as a viewer, sometimes you're like, why? And I never want, it's a distraction. I just don't want to distract. He probably has a reason that if he told us, we'd be like, oh my God, that's brilliant. But I didn't know when I'm watching it, as an example.
It is funny. You mentioned Nebraska. Whenever I hear the word black and white and unnecessary, it is also the first film that pops into my mind. And in my head, I think I forget it's black and white. It just feels like it would be in color. Why wouldn't it be?
Yeah.
So let's talk about how many hats you wear here, because you're writing, directing, producing, starring. Well, first of all, before we get into that, how did you become so adept at playing scuzzballs?
Because I am one. Can't you tell? Just so much research. I just, like, you know, I just became one. I read about being a scuzzball. I hung out with scuzzballs. I my child's a scuzzball. My wife's a scuzzball. I'm joking. I think it's because it's, you know what? It's fun. It's fun. Why is it? Why did Anthony Hopkins have a great time playing Hannibal Lecter? Like, it's fun. And those kinds of characters play with the other characters. They manipulate them. They toy with them. And it's more fun to be at a cause point, I think, when you're playing a character than being at the effect point all the time. You kind of want to be the one making the dance happen a lot. And so I guess my tendencies and my tastes move in that direction. So I end up playing them all the time. And I think it's great. And also, like, the idea of likability of like an actor or a performer, that kind of annoys me. So I think I shy away from that in general. I'm like, I don't want to be trying to be liked. I don't want to be the hero. It just is boring to me. Honestly, it's very boring.
Well, I feel like people confuse likability and charm to some degree, because there is a difference. And one of the notes I took was, because when I think about you and all the stuff that I've seen you in the series and the films, I think the words I would use would be a charming desperation.
Yeah, okay.
In most of those roles.
My wife had that in her vows, I think, when we got married.
Very good. Smart. But charm and likability, you can be charming and I can still loathe you as a character. And I love hating characters. It's one of my favorite things to do is hate a character.
Me too. It's what you're looking forward to seeing them on screen again. And I think that comes in reveling in it. And also as the performer enjoying doing the performance, not just the character enjoying doing the manipulating. It's like, I'm having fun messing with everyone. So there is enjoyment to it, which is probably why it comes across as with a certain level of charisma. It's probably because I'm having a good time.
Well, they seem like they would be a lot more fun to play. So back to the whole hat wearing. Talk to me about the challenge. I mean, this is your first feature as a filmmaker. You've made a bunch of shorts, but your first feature. So I'm curious, what were sort of the challenges of wearing all of those hats on your first outing? And what was your, you know, this is such a trite question, but I always ask it anyway because I like to know. What is your favorite part of that process? Are you having more fun when you're writing, directing, acting?
That's not a trite question at all. Because the answer is it's all of it. It's when you. I loved directing a script that I wrote that I can act in because I understand it fully, and I'm like, great. Here's what we need. I need you to do this. I don't like downtime. I don't want to sit around and just do nothing. I have a lot of energy and excitement for everything I do. Like, you know what I mean? I've done 15 interviews today. I'm having a blast here with you right now. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I enjoy doing the things I'm doing. And so I don't want to be on set sitting in the chair waiting for a setup. I want to be creating the setup. So I love that. I love that so much. The only thing I don't like when you say it's like, what was the challenge, is developing a movie, trying to get it put together and waiting, waiting. And or like administrative type things. You know, I did a movie with Hugh Jackman called The Front Runner. And I remember he had produced a little, and he's seen the movie actually, but he was really sweet. But he knew I was going to make a film soon. And like, that's what I wanted to do. So I asked him, I was like, didn't you produce, you put your name on a few of your things as producer. He said, yes. And I said, do you think you'll ever do it again? He said, the first day I went into the office and someone said, hey, I never got my rental car. Can you help me out? He's like, I'm never producing again. And I was like, yeah, I hear you. It's the administrative work too. Some people revel in that. And I want to be creative.
So was this film a COVID baby or was it kicked off before the pandemic?
This was a preemie COVID. This was December of 2019. We just got it made, but it did delay our posts and our release and blah 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 blah. So don't worry, COVID got us too, but just not in the intimate sense.
Yeah, because it has that intimate quality to it. You could easily watch it and think, oh, it's a COVID movie. They went out and they shot, but I also had the feeling that it might have been pre-COVID. So you mentioned The Front Runner, which is fun because that is actually. That was, you know, you always have that moment when you're watching a film, you're like, oh, who's that actor? And that was actually the first film that I actually noticed you as a performer in.
Oh, wow.
I was like, oh, who is this person? And then this person looks familiar. And I was like, oh, this is the guy from Arrival. And then it just does the whole spiral thing down.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
The Front Runner has that play. So what was the moment in the filmmaking process, keeping in mind you've directed shorts before, this is your first feature, where you were able to just sit back and go, you know, God damn it, I'm a filmmaker.
I think it was like day three, because the first couple of days we're out on location, like we're driving scenes and stuff, so we weren't really like settled. And you know, you're doing a kind of stunt sort of work, and which is always piecemeal, and it doesn't feel like we were actually doing a scene and performing. And then once we got into the church, we're day three, I think we were in the church, and I was like, yeah, I know how to do this. This is great. I know where that goes. I know who he is. Like, I felt at home, and I was like, I could stay here all day. Like, this is comfortable. and I think a lot of directors say that, like starting with the piecemeal stuff, those 1/8 of a page scenes, they're tough because they don't really have a beginning, middle, and end. They're a transitory piece into something else. So that stuff, it took a couple of days for me to, I think, enjoy it would be the word. I was comfortable, but to really enjoy it.
Well, I'm curious, obviously you had appeared with Henry in Ready or Not, and Henry's the lead of this film. And that's, talk about an actor that I've followed for years and years and years, and has been around forever doing great work. And nothing tickled me more than watching the new Mission Impossible trailer and hearing that monologue from the first film.
Yeah.
But it's awesome. It's awesome when you get to see these sort of like veteran, venerable actors who've been around for so long, and you know their faces, you know their names, but they just don't get a lot of leading role opportunities. And so was Henry someone that, did you write this with him in mind? Was he just someone that popped immediately into your head? How did that come about?
He didn't, and not because I didn't think he was amazing. I think I was just like, I was kind of narrow-mindedly pigeonholing a certain feel and look of someone who I didn't even exist in real life, but it was just like, I had this idea. And then I ran into Henry at the LA premiere of Ready or Not. And I was just, man, Henry is the guy. Like he, cause he's such a great actor. And like what you said, I was like, I want to see what he would, here's the thing. I want to sit at the monitor being like, what's he going to do? Like, I want that enjoyment level of, I don't know what he's going to do. And let's just see, because he's such a great actor. I don't know what's going to come out. And I mean, after you're 4 or 5 days into shooting, you're into a rhythm and you're like, I understand how he's playing the character and stuff. But that's what I was really looking forward to. And you're right. Like when people don't, like Mimi, I called Mimi Kuzik and I was like, I'm going to send you the script, blah, blah, blah. And then she called me back like the next day and she was like, no one has ever thought of me for a role like this. I was like, well, fantastic. That's one of the reasons I want you to do it. Like, that's interesting to me. I always loved how Bennett Miller cast his movies. Like having Jonah Hill in Moneyball, having Steve Carell in Foxcatcher, like kind of just... Yeah. Kind of going against the grain in a lot of ways. And I always love it when I see that. Oh, I want to see that actor do that.
Yeah, I think of Tarantino a lot when I think about that sort of thing. Yeah. Just his ability to pluck these actors that you just haven't thought about in ages, like, you know, Pam Grier or someone like that. It's like, oh, holy crap, that's right. They can lead a movie.
Yeah, yeah. Or Bruce Dern or like,
yeah,
you know, Michael Madsen or Michael Parks, like, you know what I mean? Just taking people that you're not used to seeing doing something. David Carradine, it makes it exciting because I don't want to see something I've seen before. Why would I do that? Why don't I just watch the thing I've seen before?
Yeah, I mean, we all want to watch Bruce Dern unless it's in black and white.
Yeah.
then maybe not so much.
Yeah.
So, you know, one of the things that stuck out to me watching the film, the things that I really appreciated, I'm a sucker for sound design. I became obsessed with sound design after I watched Blair Witch Project for the first time, knowing everything that went into that and how meager it was and knowing how amazing that sound design was. It just kind of sparked in me. And this film, I feel like, I don't feel like there's ever a real moment of silence in the film, not actual silence.
Yeah.
Because always in the background, there's this ominous wind and like this howl that's just in the background. I want to know what went into the sound design in your mind, and did that shape out the way you wanted it to?
It's relentless, and that's because your subconscious is relentless. It's always working. You don't even know it. Everything you do is dictated to some degree by something hidden within you that you're not aware of at that moment. And so the sound is constantly doing that. The music is constantly doing that because it's what Frederick is going through. It's a relentlessness of howling of and then when it builds, when it gets worse, it's a storm outside. And then finally at the end, things calm down. You know what I mean? There's some sort of resolution to the piece. So that's what that was for me. The sound design is constantly like just pushing, just needling and just pushing and just twisting and annoying him. And because he's brought this on himself. So that's what that was. Yeah.
Yeah. It's super effective. And I just from the beginning, like you said, relentless is a good word because it is relentless. It's always there. It's sort of like a character unto itself.
Yeah.
So my next question, I guess, is I'm a sucker for, I mean, I love dialogue in film anyway. Like, I'm definitely the guy who wants to watch two characters just sit down at a table and have a conversation, which you have a very extended sort of centerpiece scene between your character and Henry's character, Fred. And the film that popped into my mind, because it probably recency bias, is, I don't know if you've seen After Yang, the Koganada film.
Oh, I know what you're talking about. I haven't seen
it. Yeah. one of my favorite films of the year so far. And it's got a really extended sequence there in the middle. And I seem to be noticing that a lot more in films the last two or three years, like people going back to that, which obviously was a big thing in the 70s. And, you know, we were used to seeing that. The 80s sort of popified it and went away. But when you're writing dialogue, every writer does it differently. I do it than a lot of other people. Like when you're working on those dialogue between the two characters, how do you do that? Now, are you someone who, I know some writers who will verbalize the dialogue themselves. I know some people who will act it out with their partners or significant others. Do you do anything like that, or does it just rest in your head?
No, it just rests in my head, and then I go over and over and over and over and over and over and over. And I think with those long dialogue scenes, look, I remember a producer telling me years ago, they were like, you can't have a 9-page scene. It was a different script, different producer. And I was like, why not? Like, it's a movie, anything can happen. And I immediately, they kind of rallied against that. And I think that's one of the reasons why in my first film, there were like 3 9-page scenes. But for me, the most important thing with those scenes is that you have to write it knowing that you shouldn't cut any of it, because every line should lead to the next line. So you can't cut out the middle of the scene, because the end of the scene won't make any sense. So it's like, this person says something, and specifically because they said that, this person says that. And specifically because they said that, they said that. Much like a court case, much like a debate. So if you take out a debate, your closing argument won't make any sense if you cut out the middle. So that's the way I always think about it, is that each thing is a punch. It's almost like, you know, a really thought out Floyd Mayweather belt match, where it's like every punch really matters in the end.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, that makes total sense. And that seems super effective. And I think it, you know, people crap on like long dialogue scenes. I think long dialogue scenes are only a bad idea if they're badly written. I mean, if it's well written, why do you care? I want to sit with for 9 minutes and watch characters talk.
The before the Sunrise series, I mean, those are, the movie is dialogue. The whole movie is a dialogue scene, and they're great. So it's like, when people come up with rules, one thing that I don't like when you write a script, some people are like, oh yeah, the structure. I'm like, who cares about structure? Is it good? Is it effective? Did you respond to it? We don't need to have rules. Art shouldn't have rules. If it did, then we would have made a rule probably 10 years ago, 20 years ago, you can't stream something. That's a rule. And then we would never have all these movies that were available to watch. So if you come up with a rule, it's silly in art. It's a waste of everybody's time.
Well, art is in itself kind of the antithesis of rules. I mean, exactly. It is. It's sort of exactly against that. So I agree with you 100%. So you grew up in Newfoundland, right?
Yep.
So when did your love of film overall, not just horror, obviously, but film, when did that sort of develop for you? Have you been a film fan since you were a kid, or is this something you kind of grew into?
1996, when I saw Primal Fear with Edward Norton. And I was like, oh my God, someone, he's good at acting. I just knew before, like, Tom Hanks is a star. Before, I didn't know that someone could be good at it. I was like, he is really good at acting. Like, that guy is good at this job. I was only 12. I didn't grow up in a artistic household so much. And we were in a small town. I wasn't going to the movies all the time. I went to the movies like any kid. I went to see Jurassic Park and, like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And all the Touchstones and Die Hard movies and everything. And I still love those movies, but it was around that time. And then not long after, I mean, Google Hunting. And then 1999, the best year of movies probably in the history of cinema. It was like, wow. It was like, oh my God, Magnolia and Fight Club and Election and Any Given Sunday and Matrix and just like insane. And like, what is happening in 1999? Everyone's making American Beauty. Everybody made a great movie in 1999. And I was 15. And that year I was just like, oh my, what a great coincidence that I was 15 in 1999, which was, it is the best year for movies.
Yeah.
And I was like, this is crazy. There's so many good movies. And we saw Fight Club and we just freaked out. Me and my buddies were like, oh my God, it was the coolest movie I've ever seen in my life. And then on the weekends, we just made movies. And from then on, I never stopped making movies, either on the weekends with a camcorder or professionally. So it was Primal Fear really kicked it off. And then it was Google Hunting. And then it was 99.
Well, I love hearing Primal Fear get any love, because I love that film too. Still one of the best endings. Just one of the best reveals.
So good. So good. What a great, and what an underrated performance by Richard Gere. Because obviously, Ed Norton, but it was like Richard Gere is so good in that movie.
I feel like that's Richard Gere's lot in life, is to be the actor that everybody's always like, oh yeah, and Richard Gere was awesome too.
They're like, oh yeah, at the time we didn't appreciate it.
We really don't. I don't really think we appreciate Richard Gere enough.
He's amazing. He's amazing in that movie. Man, oh man, totally overlooked performance.
I have a lot of questions that I would ask if it wasn't going to get into spoiler territory, because I don't want to spoil anything. But without giving anything away, I do want to ask, was there a specific inspiration for the last shot of the film?
No. And no. I'm very happy to say that, because I love a good surprise ending. I love a flashy ending. I love Basic Instincts, last shot. I love it when it's like, and the last shot of the movie is crazy. I'm like, oh my God, I can't wait to see it. Like Enemy, Denis Villeneuve's Enemy. Like stuff like that. You're like, oh my God, I'll sit through 3 fucking hours just to see this last 10 second shot. There's something really, really pleasing about it to me. So it kind of came naturally, and it was inspired by nothing. It was inspired by nothing. And that's why my answer to you was so quick, because I was like, I've never seen that before. I've never seen that really before. So I'm going to put in something I've never seen before. That completely, I think, makes the movie whole in a strange way. It somehow makes the movie whole.
Yeah, it's like, it's a nice little coda there. And it reminded me, not in what it's doing, but it's like why I love Serious Man. That's the reason I could watch Serious Man every day, is like that last shot of that film.
Love that.
Just bonkers good. But yeah, I don't want to spoil it. People can discover that on themselves. I was just curious because it's such a striking sort of final moment of the film.
Yeah, yeah. And it's all me, baby.
Hey, that's good. That's the best. So my favorite scene in the film, which I have to mention and get your, because I just thought this was such an exceptionally well-directed scene, and we haven't really talked a lot about you as a director yet. And so the scene with Doris, the first scene with Doris, is just so, for anybody who's ever been in an awkward conversation that they desperately want to get out of, but the person just doesn't have any cues that they want it to be over. Like, that's the scene for them. And I'm curious, like, is that scene exactly the way you envisioned it in your head? And talk a little bit about directing that scene, because it just stood out to me.
Thank you. I'm so glad you mentioned that, because that her character, Kate's character, Doris, comes in and takes the movie in another direction. I was like, you come in, your character that shouldn't exist in this world that we've established so far in the first 10 minutes or so, you should not exist. All of a sudden, this bubbly, like loud, unaware person comes into this dour family drama. And it just doesn't seem right that she's kind of there, which is great because it throws them off kilter and it's kind of a foreshadow to my character. But I will say it's so uncomfortable and like awkward. It was 3 minutes longer and it was too uncomfortable. It was like, fuck, this is so uncomfortable. She is just insufferable. Like, get her out of the house. And one of the reasons we cut it down, the performances were all great, was it was really like they would usher her out by now. That's what it was getting towards. So then we find the right amount, and the direction was a lot in finding it like on the day, but in the edit too, of like, what is just the right amount so that they feel for her? I appreciate you mentioning that, because the direction of that is like, they have to feel, they have sympathy for her, but they also can't stand her.
Yeah.
And she's also a walking tragedy. So the audience feels bad for her too, but they're not sure why. There's so many things going on while she's also revealing a lot of expository information. So you're like, what? And like, who? And oh, what? Like, that's kind of the audience reaction, I think, when they're watching that scene. They're like, what is this movie? I always feel like when you start watching a movie, you know if you're in good hands in the first 2 minutes, right? You always know this filmmaker's going to take you on a journey that makes sense. And I feel very confident in my film that, like, you can tell from the beginning, it's like, oh, this person seems to know what they're doing. And I feel like that scene comes along like 12 minutes in or something. You're like, maybe this filmmaker doesn't know what this scene is really bizarre, and just, but not that bizarre, that it's just kind of weird and the tone is strange. And it was very intentional. So I love that scene, but that's what it was. It was balancing a lot of things so that it still makes sense within the world of the movie, while also still making you question what could be. And it's a foreshadow, really. It's a foreshadow point, what's going to happen.
Well, you mentioned, which is interesting too, you were describing the Doris character. And the way you were describing the Doris character, you know, honestly, to a large degree, could be copied over to your character from City on a Hill, or yeah. something like that. So, I mean, maybe you're the right person to direct that kind of energy.
Yeah, yeah.
that charming desperation.
Making everyone uncomfortable and should leave. Yes. I think giving her a Charlestown accent in it, too. Should give her a nice Boston accent to do a City on a Hill wink. No, but yeah, it's a fine balance for sure.
You mentioned accent. That's a great segue. As someone who, of course, does not have an accent himself, you know, mine's perfectly neutral. what was the inspiration behind your accent in the film, and where did that come from?
It's No Time, No Place, the movie. So if we all have slightly different accents, then it'll push that notion further, because, you know, we have a German priest, we have two North American sounding people. Kate kind of has a bit of a Newfoundland accent naturally. And then I have a Southern accent. So you're like, where is this? Where are we? Yeah. And the reason why I chose Southern, I didn't want to do European, because European is really definitive of a country.
Yeah.
And if I did New York or Boston or whatever, but the South, yes, there are many, like I've done Oklahoma, I've done New Orleans in different movies, but just, I'm kind of doing a generic Southern accent, which covers the most geographical area of any place in the world, really, that is non-specific to one place.
Yeah.
So that way it made him even more ambiguous. You're like, he could be from a lot of different places.
Yeah. Well, as a proud Alabamian, I when I hear a Southern accent, I just have to know more, especially when it's in a film that is distinctively not Southern.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, why is this happening? But that was the reason. It's like, it just added more question marks of this guy.
Yeah. So you seem to be pretty busy in the world of television these days. I think 61st Street just wrapped up its run, if I'm correct. And then I believe Perry Mason season 2 is coming as well.
Yeah.
And I guess the question everybody wants to know is Jimmy really dead?
Jimmy's dead. he's dead. I remember when I got that show, I was like, this character ain't living long. Reading like the first script, I was like, no way he's making it very long. So when I died on it, I knew. I was like, when we got a second season, I was like, when does Jimmy die? Like, obviously, you know, but that was a fun character. Those were the most fun characters I've ever gotten to play. It was great.
And 61st Street, you know, you're working with Courtney B. Vance, who is, you know, God level good in anything. I'm curious. So has it been great? Has it been a hit for a second season yet? Or is it?
It's a limited series. It's only 2 seasons.
Well, it's only 2 seasons until someone expands.
Yeah. It ends pretty definitively. I won't give away any more than that. But season 1 just finished airing, but it's streaming on AMC Plus. But season 2, I think, is going to come out next year. But like I said, we shot it. So that series is done for me.
Oh, okay. So
they'll get season 2 next year.
Okay. Well, you know, you never know. Maybe there's... That seems to be the thing now, is let's do a limited series and then just expand it for 8 seasons.
Maybe I'll come back on 61st Street as Jimmy Ryan from City on a Hill.
I like mixing those things together.
Yeah,
I've got one more question for you, sir, and it's the most important question I'm going to ask, because this is a podcast called Movies with Gravy. I'm a proud Southerner. What is your favorite type of gravy?
Oh, my God. You know what? This is bad.
No, don't say that you've never had gravy.
No, I'm saying this on the record, and I shouldn't. I don't like gravy anymore. Uh-huh. Because my mom, if you're listening, I love you to death. You're the best mom in the world. But I hated my mom's gravy so much. Now, I have come along to having my father-in-law makes gravy, turkey dinner. I don't know how he makes it or what's in it or what it's called. And I'm starting to come back. But man, it's been a tough adulthood with my relationship with gravy.
Now, did she make brown gravy?
God, I don't even know what the difference is. Should I know?
Well, you know, you've got your brown gravy, which is what you associate with Thanksgiving. You've got your white gravy, which is something we eat in the South a lot. And then you have your red eye gravy.
What's red eye?
Red eye gravy is made out of lard and coffee.
No, never had that. Yeah. I definitely have brown gravy. My mom used to make brown gravy. What was the second one?
White gravy.
I think my in-laws, they're British, which I feel like light gravy might be a bit of a British thing. I think it's light gravy. It certainly looks lighter than my mom's brown sludge.
Now, do you think that was your mom's fault, though? Or was it just the nature of gravy itself that you weren't into?
Oh, it's entirely my mom's fault.
Okay.
It ruined my relationship with gravy.
you know, it all stems back to the parents, I think.
Always. Look at The Righteous. I should put in that gravy subplot.
Gravy does not get the respect it deserves. I wish I could say this podcast was created to appreciate Gravy. It wasn't. But we do like to talk about it as much as possible. Finally, I know I said that was my last question, but I always want to ask, you know, what is coming up for you? What is on your docket other than promoting The Righteous, trying to get the word out about that?
Well, I'm still shooting Perry Mason. So okay. I'm literally in the midst of shooting that. And then trying to make the next thing. I've become a bit more particular over time of the things I want to do. And so I'm okay to mull over the next one. I still have several months of shooting left anyway. And, you know, I'm trying to make the next movie. I have a bunch of scripts in development at different places with different companies. And whoever, you know, whoever's going to sign that check, I'm going to be very excited to cash it and then make my movie with it. So that's kind of what I'm working towards more than anything, really. Every day I'm working on trying to make the next one.
Yeah, that's all you can do. Keep plugging away. It's so easy, isn't it?
It's the simplest job ever.
Mark, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us.
You're the man. This was fun, man. I really like this.
Yeah, had a great time. I appreciate it. And best of luck with the film. I'm sure folks are going to dig it. So,
thanks so much. Take care, man. Thanks for watching it.
You too. Bye, Mark.
Bye.
Movies with Gravy is hosted by me, Billy Ray Bruton, and produced by Ryan Barrell. Theme song is Country Roses by me, Billy Ray Bruton, and Flannery Whaley. Don't forget to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts and join our Patreon army at patreon.com/incineratorpod. And remember, movies are great, but they're better with gravy. Y'all come back now, you hear?
Country roses, blessed songs, mommy's here, daddy's gone. Broken promises, gin and rye, all the mean and hurtful things that make babies.